content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Romani Arrowsmith from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Vogue and Rookie Magazine. The theme of this episode is identity. This first essay is actually a short story from Rookie Magazine by Pixie Casey. It's called What's in a Name? 1. Evangeline. My parents named me after an epic poem, which is so my parents that it really couldn't have surprised anyone when they announced it. My mother says she read the poem when she was a young girl and the name stuck with her. She says, I thought it was the most beautiful name I'd ever seen then, and I feel the same way now. Of course she does. It's much easier to fall in love with a name that isn't yours. In order to love your own name, you have to admit that it fits you. You have to believe that this is true. You have to own it and be glad that you carry it with you. Many people can do this. Other people can't for various and often totally valid reasons. I'm somewhere in between, I guess. It's not that I don't like my name. It's just that I keep trying to find the best version of it. The one that suits me the most. 2. Lean. The first two words I learned were the first words that mostly everyone learns. Mama and Dada. My parents then expected me to learn my own 10-letter, 4-syllable name, which is a bit like teaching someone to swim, and then asking them to win a gold medal at the Olympics on the very same day. My mother says she sat with me for hours, repeating Evangeline over and over in the hopes that I'd comprehend it and repeat it back to her. Eventually, I responded with Lean, which I think is pretty good for a tiny baby with a limited vocabulary. My parents were so delighted that they referred to me as Lean almost exclusively until I was 5 and headed off to kindergarten. 3. Tangerine. Now, if anyone asks you your name, what are you going to say? My mother was tying my hair back before my first day of school and trying to reinforce the great Evangeline push that my parents had picked up once again. They knew I'd learn to spell my full name. They knew I'd need to learn to spell my full name at school and had only referred to me as Evangeline for months in order to prepare me for using it on a regular basis. I say nothing, I said. I don't talk to strangers. Well, you've got me there, my mother said. The kids in my kindergarten class struggled a bit with my name. One spent the entire year calling me Eventually. Another, Evan Davis, called me Tangerine, which the other kids loved and adopted as well. I was Tangerine Powell for all of kindergarten, much to my delight, because I loved tangerines and thought they accounted for the prettiest shade of orange. Also, they smell delightful, so it really can't be taken as an insult. Tangerine was fun to say, and people liked to say it, so it made me somewhat popular. I felt like I was fun as well. It was good to be Tangerine. I started signing all my drawings Tangerine, which drove my parents and my teacher, Mrs. Winter, a bit mad. They had a conference to discuss the Tangerine problem, and the result was a ban on the name both in and out of the classroom. Your name is Evangeline, my mother told me gently. It's a beautiful name. It's important that you use it. So I did, until I didn't. 4. Ava. In 5th grade, I started hanging out with a new group of girls that I'd met through soccer. Allison, Madison, Olivia, and Isabella. Only, they didn't go by those names. They were Allie, Maddie, Liv, and Bella. I, for my part, was super jealous. In the hopes of changing that, I wrote my name down and started considering options for my own cool nickname. There was Angel right in the center of my name, but that felt too forced. Lena might work, but didn't feel right either. Finally, I settled on lopping the last 7 letters off my name. Ava. At least, I tried to go by Ava. I brought it up at soccer practice one afternoon, and the conversation went a little like this. I can't call you Ava, said Maddie. You're not an Ava. You're an Evangeline. What if we call you Evangelina Ballerina? Suggested Allie. We can't call her that, said Bella. That's longer than her name is already. A nickname doesn't have to be shorter than a first name, Allie argued. Pretty sure it does, Bella shot back. I think your name is really pretty, Liv said shyly. It sounds like a fairy princess or something.
Oh, ew, said Maddie. We're trying to make her like her name, remember?
This went on for several minutes before everyone got bored and moved on. When our parents came to pick us up from practice, we did what we always did. Obnoxiously yelled goodbye to one another as we got into our parents' cars. Nobody screamed, "Goodbye, Ava!" Instead, "Goodbye, Evangeline!" 5. Angel. The summer before 8th grade, I had a boyfriend for approximately 2 weeks who thought it was cute to call me Angel and write me notes that said, "Dear Evangeline," with the angel capitalized. I was right about how wrong this sounded to me at 10. I don't miss him. 6. Tangerine returns. I don't think I'm particularly memorable, but Evan Davis remembered me. He moved away in 3rd grade, but he was back for the first day of sophomore year, thanks to his mom's job transfer back to town. He was sitting in my biology class when I walked in, and when our eyes met, he smiled and yelled, "Tangerine, it's you!" I felt sick to my stomach. Here was this kid who remembered a 5-year-old version of me, who had missed the last 10 years of my life and knew nothing about me, assuming familiarity because of a nickname I'd used in kindergarten. For all I loved about Tangerine, I didn't feel like hiding behind her again. Maddie, whom it should be noted, started going by Madison in 9th grade, sat down next to me and laughed. "Why is that new kid calling you Tangerine?" I explained the situation, and she giggled. "Well, that's it," she said. "I'm calling you Tangerine forever." "I'd rather you didn't," I told her. "But it's so cute," she said. "But it's not me." And I felt that in my toes, and at the tips of my fingers, which also felt like me, in a way that was uncontrived, unforced, uncomplicated. I turned to Evan Davis. "Hey," I yelled toward him. "Call me Evangeline." This next story is also from Rookie Magazine and is a first-person account from Addie Sartino, who is the lead singer of a band called The Grading Committee. It's called The Ways I Wear My Pride, continuing on with this theme of identity. "Hi, I'm Addie Sartino. I'm the lead singer of the indie alt band, unknown as The Grading Committee. I'm a performer, writer, daughter, sister, friend, feminist, businesswoman, and member of the LGBTQ+ community. My sexuality made the bottom of the list, not because it's a hidden part of who I am, but because it's not all I am, nor is it at the forefront of who I am. I have so much more to offer than who I choose to kiss." Ridiculous as it sounds, I've refrained from using the word "hey" ever since I watched 500 Days of Summer 6 years ago. There's a point in the movie when the leading woman, Summer, seems uninterested in the leading man, Tom. As Tom's friends try offering potential explanations, one asks, "Did she say hey instead of hi? Because you know that means she's a lesbian, right? Because a woman can't be uninterested in a man unless she's gay, right? That theory doesn't check out for a number of reasons, but we won't get into all of them right now. The point is, closeted 14-year-old me totally thought my cover was blown from saying hey all those years. I've never wanted to be defined in the brief amount of time an introduction takes. Fast forward to age 20, and while I sometimes still catch myself guarding my sexuality, I have also come a long way in the ways I wear my pride. As the front woman of a band, there are times when all eyes are on me. Because of this, I've been given many opportunities and experiences, all new, all rewarding, and all difficult to varying degrees. My favorite, however, has been the chance to become a role model, someone worth looking up to. It's not something I take lightly. I'm psychologically an only child turned oldest child. This makes me type A, and it also makes me a leader, another facet of my identity I don't take lightly. To me, being a role model means showing those who look to you a place of safety, acceptance, growth, and accountability. I do this through my words, music, and actions. This can be challenging at times, as I'm human, and with that comes flaws and mistakes. Note, there's a lot of them. But at times, flaws and mistakes are the actions that show my fans that growth and accountability are imperative in being someone admirable. It's not the spotlight that scares me. It's blowing my chance to be the kind of leader people deserve. On top of being the front woman of a band, I'm a queer front woman. This throws me into yet another subcategory, but an awesome one. This is where my ideals of a good role model come in. At least once a week, someone messages me looking for advice on their sexuality. It astounds me. How lucky am I that I get to help someone who's in the same position I was in just 5 years ago? Many of the messages articulate the same confusions. What am I? Who am I? How do I categorize myself? What if I don't identify with a label? All of these questions are what got me to the realization of what I stand for. My sexuality is not who I am. I have so much more to offer than who I choose to kiss. The pressure of sexual identity can feel so heavy because our society highlights it so boldly. From an evolutionary standpoint, we're essentially programmed to categorize ourselves and others. When questioning your sexuality, there's a sense of panic. If I am not who I thought I was, then who am I? Stand firm in who you do know you are outside of who you love, and feel the weight on your shoulders become lighter. Others may present limitations and labels, but no one can put you in a box if you don't put yourself in one. This bit of advice applies to all aspects of life. Don't let the fear of others' judgments dictate your comfort with yourself or your sexuality. I personally do not identify strongly with one particular label. It took me years to look at myself with love and say, "That's okay. You are enough. Your heart needs no boundary." And the only real reason I could say this to myself was because I established who I am and who I want to be in other areas of my life. My rainbow flag is not dull just because I don't wear it as a cape every day. It seems there's a mold in the LGBTQ+ community that some feel pushed into, as if you can't be proud unless you are loud. This is untrue and, frankly, unfair. I am in love with a girl who I can't get enough of, and I scream it from the rooftops, but only the rooftops I choose. Just as she chooses her own rooftops to scream from, and boy am I lucky it's my name being yelled. This doesn't reflect how much we love each other, just as it doesn't reflect our pride in our sexuality. Remember, your voice, your choice. My goal is to show others that they should be confident in ways that make them comfortable. So, you're a trans woman, you're bisexual, you're questioning, you're gay, you're asexual, you're non-binary, you're a fighter, you're a son, you're a brother, you're a poet, you're a scientist, you're a photographer, you're an athlete, you're an activist, you're a movie fanatic. You can quote every episode of Friends and you know every word to Hey Ya by Outkast. You're brave, you're loved, and you have so much more to offer than who you choose to kiss. You have so much more to offer than who you choose to kiss. Okay, this next piece is from Vogue magazine, and it's a profile of actress Margot Robbie, who has to take on many different identities to do her job well. Margot Robbie always thought that once she was a good enough actor, she would write Quentin Tarantino a letter, just to get on his radar, or at least to let him know how much his movies meant to her. She was sure people must tell him that all the time, but still. "I've always been a huge, huge Tarantino fan," she tells me one afternoon in Los Angeles. "I love his movies. Love them." After Robbie watched the first cut of I, Tonya, the 2017 biopic about figure skater Tonya Harding, which Robbie produced and starred in, she decided she was finally good enough. The performance would earn her an Oscar nomination. "So I wrote him and said, 'I adore your films and I would love to work with you in some capacity, or any capacity.'" When Tarantino received Robbie's letter, he'd recently finished the script for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, a romp through the movie industry of the late 1960s, which opens this month. Friends who'd read the script had already asked if he'd be casting Robbie in the role of Sharon Tate, the actress, wife of Roman Polanski, and most famous victim of the Manson murders. Then Robbie's letter arrived. The timing was spooky enough that Tarantino thought they should meet. Soon, Robbie was sitting at the director's kitchen table reading the script. Robbie is a careful reader. It took her 4 hours. Tarantino would occasionally pop in to offer her food or a Victoria Bitter, an Australian beer. When I later ask Tarantino what made Robbie right for the role, he tells me,
Margot looks like Sharon Tate, and she can convey Sharon's innocence and purity. Those qualities are integral to the story. Tarantino's film is about the end of Hollywood's golden age, but Robbie, who is 28, has come to represent so much of what's new. As an Australian soap actress, she entered Hollywood being typecast. She played the bronzed, gold-digging beauty in Martin Scorsese's The Wolf of Wall Street, the hot blonde explaining mortgage bonds from a bubble bath in 2015's The Big Short, and Jane following Alexander Skarsgård's Tarzan into the Congo. But it turned out Robbie wanted more than these roles. It turned out that she wanted to put on a fat suit for I, Tonya and to cover her face in boils for Mary, Queen of Scots, and to produce female-driven projects via her production company, Lucky Chap Entertainment. Part of the charm in Robbie's Tarantino story is that it, like the film itself, sounds very old Hollywood. An aspiring actress writes a fan letter to an auteur director in hopes of getting cast in one of his nostalgia-loving films. But Hollywood is changing, and while Robbie may have arrived at the end of an era, she is now among the women ushering in a new one. Today we're on the set of Birds of Prey, a spin-off of 2016's Suicide Squad that Robbie developed and pitched to Warner Brothers as an R-rated, female-led superhero action film, a commercialized product of New Hollywood, if ever there was one. I think there's a perception that a PG female-led action film is kind of considered a chick flick, says Robbie. At $75 million, this is Lucky Chap's largest project to date, but Robbie seems unperturbed. Well, we're on schedule and on budget, which is a wonderful place to be. In Birds, which is due out next year, Robbie will reprise her role as Harley Quinn, the Joker's ex. But today, she's primarily a producer. Wandering the set in jeans and a smiley face t-shirt with two hearts for eyes, her cell phone suspended from a rope in place of a purse, she introduces me to the women who work with her. Kathy Yan, the director, Jody, the script supervisor, Sue, a producer. We run into Mary Elizabeth Winstead, who has spent the day performing stunts as Huntress, a crossbow-wielding vigilante. Winstead pulls down her track pants to reveal a bruise on her hip. Robbie says, "That looks legit." The day's shoot is at a medieval-style stone abbey in Highland Park. "Sorry I'm not taking you to paint mugs or something," Robbie says. She's referring to the tropes of celebrity profiles, the skydiving or skateboarding or whatever else actresses are supposed to do to charm writers. When I say that it is nearly impossible to find a story in which she is not described as a bombshell, Robbie suppresses an eye roll. I hate that word. I hate it so much. I feel like a brat saying that because there are worse things, but I am not a bombshell. I'm not someone who walks in a room and the record stops and people turn like, "Look at that woman." That doesn't happen. People who know me, if they had to sum me up in one word, I don't know what that word would be, but I'm certain it would not be bombshell. Glamorous movie star isn't really Robbie's vibe. She laughs easily, curses liberally, and is more likely to opt for a shared trailer if it means making room in the budget for something else. Here she is on the outlandish demands, or so she's heard, of certain actors to have their bathtubs filled with Evian water. They must have a massive insecurities they're compensating for. Sophia Kerr, Robbie's childhood friend and now business partner, who met her as a braces-wearing, emo-metal-listening pre-tween in Australia, describes Robbie as someone who likes a good time, whether it's taking belly dancing lessons in Marrakesh, going to see Celine Dion in London, or trudging through mud at Glastonbury. Nicole Kidman, her co-star in director Jay Roach's forthcoming and still untitled film about sexual harassment at Fox News, calls Robbie a powerhouse. "She's just got incredible ease," Kidman says. "She seems to be unbelievably mature, and she's managed to kind of float with everything. She doesn't seem to have resistance. She's very powerful in how she approaches her life and her work." When I ask Kidman, a fellow Aussie, if she sees a difference between her own path in the industry and Robbie's, she says, "I didn't have the opportunity to produce my own things or control my destiny like that, so that is definitely different." A lot of actors want to be producers, but Robbie seems to actually think like one. On I, Tonya, it was common for her to skate off the ice to go over locations or to discuss budgets from the makeup chair. When Robbie landed her first American TV gig on ABC's short-lived Pan Am, She asked the cinematographer so many questions that one day he handed her a copy of the Five C's of Cinematography. At home, in her bedroom closet, Robbie has written the classical structure of a screenplay on large swaths of butcher paper, so that she can give thoughtful notes while on calls with writers. Roach recalls their first meeting for the Isles film, when Robbie nudged him to add layers to her character, a fictional Fox News associate producer. She just sort of said, "I'm not great at playing naive," Roach says. I thought, that's excellent, because a green newbie wouldn't be nearly as interested. Harley Quinn, Suicide Squad's baby-voiced psycho schoolgirl on roller skates, is not exactly a mascot for the emancipation of women in Hollywood. But when we drop by the wardrobe trailer so that Robbie can try on a costume intended for the next day's shoot, a sequined blazer, sports bra, and orange track shorts, I notice that this hardly seems more sporty spice than male fantasy. That's what happens when you have a female producer, director, writer, says the film's costume designer. Yeah, it's definitely less male-gazy, Robbie says. Banach tells me that Robbie has an uncanny ability to focus on what's happening in the moment, and when she needs to shift, she can so perfectly shift. She turns to Robbie. You kind of have a business mind. God, I hope so, Robbie says, or else this movie is going to fail. Birds is just one of some 50 projects on Lucky Chap's current slate. There's also Promising Young Woman, a rape revenge thriller starring Carey Mulligan, directed by actress Emerald Fennell, soon to play Camilla Parker Bowles on The Crown, Dollface, a Hulu comedy created by the 25-year-old writer Jordan Weiss, and a film adaptation of Otessa Mosfa's novel, My Year of Arrest and Relaxation. Though Lucky Chap's overarching mission is promoting projects by women, Kerr sums up the company ethos thusly. Margot once said to me, whenever we're reading things, if your immediate reaction isn't, hell yes, then it's a no. The company has just moved its offices to an industrial complex near downtown LA. Inside, there is a pink neon sign bearing the company name, Haim playing at a low volume, and Tom Ackerley, Robbie's husband and Lucky Chap co-founder, a bearded, easygoing Brit in t-shirt and jeans, perched at the marble island of a pristine tiled kitchen. This kitchen has been dubbed a Nancy Meyers kitchen, Ackerley tells me. Oh, it is so a Nancy Meyers kitchen, Robbie says. Ackerley makes his coffee on the new espresso machine that Robbie hasn't mastered yet, and retreats to his office. See ya. Press isn't Ackerley's thing, Robbie later tells me. He's usually a very loud and friendly person, but he's definitely behind the cam, she says. The story of how Robbie and Ackerley got together is also the story of Lucky Chap. It all began in 2014 when Robbie was in London promoting The Wolf of Wall Street, and she invited Kerr, as well as Ackerley and Josie McNamara, a couple of assistant directors she just met on the set of the film Suite Francaise, to the premiere. They ended up partying until the wee hours in her hotel room. In the morning, Robbie had to catch a flight to the Golden Globes. I was like, wouldn't it be fun if we all lived together? She recalls. 3 days later, the foursome signed a lease on a house in London. That same year, they founded Lucky Chap in their kitchen, and Robbie and Ackerley became a couple. They married in 2016. It's nice working with your spouse, Robbie says. We can talk about work all the time, and then work feels like fun. And fun stuff can involve work. Fun stuff has recently included a weekend glamping in Big Sur and a boogie nights-themed party with friends where Robbie dressed up as a roller girl, naturally, and Ackerley was the silks robe-wearing drug dealer played by Alfred Molina. We just get along, she says. I think it's crazy that not all couples get along. If Robbie likes a full house, it's because she grew up in one. As the second youngest of four on Australia's Gold Coast, a beachy, surfy region along the country's western edge, kind of like Miami, she says. Lots of canals and tacky people. Her mother is a physiotherapist. She doesn't love talking about her father who left when she was five. Just because it's hard to briefly mention without it sounding like, my dad's awful, and that whole thing. But yes, mom and dad split up. At 17, she moved to Melbourne to work on a soap called Neighbours, followed by brief periods in Los Angeles and New York, before settling in London with Ackerley, Kerr, and McNamara. The story behind the name Lucky Chap? Something to do with Charlie Chaplin. We were drunk and no one remembers, Robbie says, so it's kind of like a bad tattoo. I only have bad tattoos. When they moved to Los Angeles, Robbie and Akali settled on their own, though currently they have Robbie's older brother living with them, as well as her cousin and her cousin's husband. It's a common theme, isn't it? She says. I hate, hate being alone. I don't ask her about children. It was Robbie, after all, who made headlines in January by reminding everyone that such questions are not just tired, but also sexist. I got married, and the first question in almost every interview is, babies, when are you having one? She told a British Weekly. Lately, she and Ackerley have been talking about forming a little commune with Karen McNamara and touring double plots around the city. We'll be like a cult, says Robbie. When they looked at one property, Robbie asked if she could have a slide built connecting her bedroom to the pool. I think that just sums up the person that she is, Kara says. She will buy a compound on a whim so that her friends could live near her and so that she can wake and slide into the pool. Speaking of cults, we are now en route to Musso and Frank's, significant not just for its status as a Hollywood landmark, but also as a pivotal setting in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. The film follows a Western TV actor, Leonardo DiCaprio, and his stunt double Brad Pitt, who live next door to Sharon Tate, Robbie. There are also takes on Bruce Lee, Steve McQueen, and a wild-eyed Charles Manson. And that's pretty much all I can say. The project was shrouded in so much secrecy that even after signing an ironclad NDA, I was allowed to watch only a portion. Mostly, the film just feels like an incredibly fun party that you know is about to come to a terrible end. Robbie's Tate, like her Tonya Harding, is less imitation than an interpretation. Whereas Tate has always seemed ethereal and elusive, like someone in an old photograph, Robbie's performance is exuberant and in full color, like a match that's just been lit. Her prep for roles is often physical. In addition to Robbie's usual Pilates routine, her stunt training ends up being her default workout. For Tonya, she learned to ice skate. For Harley, it was roller skating and fight training. Becoming Tate was more complicated, with Robbie working with a movement coach doing something called animal work to accomplish Tate's lightness and brightness. In one scene, she levitates midair. It was such a strange challenge, Robbie says. I find it much easier to go dark and angry. With Tonya, I wanted to go really heavy, almost like she had weights on her feet. This time, I was trying to do the reverse. We're outside the restaurant now, and the air smells of grilled steak, which Robbie inhales like a scented candle. I'm such a carnivore, she says. I'm trying hard to do meatless Mondays, for, like, environment reasons, but it's so hard. And, folks, I have to stop there as we have run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Romani Arrowsmith, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.